Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News, or our monthly housing and economy update with our friend Martin North coming to us from the other side of the world. How are you, Martin?
I'm extremely well, thank you. Just moved into spring here, so all the flowers are out, the birds are singing. We're still getting a lot of rain though.
We've just started getting a bit of rain, actually. My hiking is getting a little bit colder every weekend. But interesting times in global markets. We're going to touch on some stuff happening in China as well as different aspects of inflation lingering. But any general thoughts from you before we dive into the slides?
Well, it is interesting because at one level, you could say all the markets are going gangbusters, right? Pretty much wherever you look. And so, you know, what's driving that? Is it fundamentally driven or is it actually sentiment driven? But when you start peeling the onion and looking more detail at what's going on, then the cracks begin to appear. And I think we'll get into some of that today because there are some questions ahead, I think.
Absolutely. Let's dive into it. So one of the things that's been on a tear is US stocks. Profit earnings ratio is now above 20.
Yes. So, you know, the S&P 500 knocking close to all-time highs just back very slightly overnight. But if you look at it in terms of the relative value of stocks to the earnings, at the start of the year, earnings were meant to be up around 10%. The latest forecasts are 5%, so we're starting to get into the earnings season. But with a 9% rise in the value of stocks since the start of the year, the earnings ratio is now 20.7 on average across the market, which is almost as high as it's ever been. It's the highest in 2 years. It's only ever been higher than about 21, just briefly. So you've got to ask the question, you know, are the markets really reflecting fair value, or are markets clearly expecting rate cuts very soon and are then pricing for those, and also assuming that the US is not going to go into any sort of slowdown or recession? I would say that stocks are priced for perfection. But if you then strip out the magnificent few, you know, it's not seven anymore, it's less than that, right? They are responsible for a lot of the momentum. Take those out and the markets look way overvalued. So the question now is, can the markets go on going higher? And there are many who think they will, but there are others now questioning whether in fact they're now got to the point where they are too overexpensive and therefore a correction is due.
Yeah, probably one of the things that's boosting it is that $1 trillion spending bill as well. It seems like every few months or so now there's another $1 trillion for something. So whenever there's that more money printing, I think at the end of the day that M2 money supply is just looking for real things or assets to park in, because I do include stocks and property and things like Bitcoin that maybe some people say aren't real in that bucket, but people just don't want to be in dollars at the rate that they're printing new ones.
Well, I think that the critical point is that the US dollar is still relatively strong relative to other currencies. And we clearly are seeing a lot of flows of money into the US, into the US dollar. And then you have to put them somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. So in a way, you could argue that the US dollar is the best dirty shirt out there. It's cleaner than a few others. Yes. But of course, the question is for how much longer? And what does it really do to the rest of the world if equity is drained, effectively cash is drained, and it all goes into the US and it sort of creates a bubble there? And of course, the US economy and its strength with the dollar flows out and impacts economies around the world.
Absolutely. We've both talked about that at length over the years. But next up, we got some strong US jobs.
Yes. So the really interesting story here, of course, everyone was expecting inflation to get under control. And the most recent data was a little bit off that. The most recent inflation from a month ago was stronger than expected. We have another read later on overnight. But the payroll data last Friday was superficially, at least, extremely strong, with 303,000 new jobs and the unemployment rate dropping. Now, to be clear, a lot of those jobs were part-time jobs, so it's not quite as holus bolus, everything's on the upside, as you might first think. But the markets did actually react to these numbers, and so it's the latest in a series of sequence of data points that suggests that, one, inflation could well be stronger than we expect, and two, the US economy is stronger than we were perhaps expecting. All of those then tips the conversation to, so really, are we going to get rate cuts in that context? So the data tomorrow will be critical, but there's a bit of a sort of leading thread now that suggests, well, maybe rates will stay high for longer than we were expecting. And that actually takes us quite nicely to the next slide, because, of course, we had a lot of Fed speak, particularly last week. So we had Jerome Powell saying, well, you know, we'll probably be able to do some stuff later in the year, possibly, if the data's okay. But then we had Rafael Bostic saying, well, actually, you know, there's some questions about this. And it's going to be perhaps down to the end of the year, but maybe the fourth quarter. And then we had Neil Kashari, who on Thursday said, well, maybe we're not going to cut rates until next year. So I just want to highlight that even in Fedland, you know, there's a range of views. But some of the analysts that I've been listening to and you know, reading quite recently are suggesting, well, maybe the interest rate is not high enough in the US to tackle inflation. So if inflation comes in really hot, could that actually mean we've got to see rates go higher rather than lower? And that's a big deal if that were to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And bond yields, I guess, mirroring everything you've just explained.
Yeah, so the typical movement of, you know, bond prices go down and yields go up. So we've seen the 2-year and the 10-year both higher than they were. And some people again now suggesting, well, maybe we could see bonds knocking on the 5% again. And if that's the case, then you've got this weird scenario where stock prices are high, bond prices are high, gold is high, Bitcoin, everything, silver, everything is up.
Yes.
And the question is, something's got to give. The question is, at what point does it give? And I think the question on the trajectory of the cash rate is probably the key to understanding what's going to happen next. You know, if in fact inflation comes in benignly and, you know, the Fed begins to move rates down later in the year, markets will go a lot higher. But if in fact that doesn't happen, if we actually see rates sticking or going higher, then markets are probably overvalued in some sectors. And trying to work out which of those two scenarios comes through is confusing because, of course, the Fed is saying, well, we're going to be very data dependent and the data is all over the place. So the question I have is the Fed now over dependent on data? Has it got no sense in its own mind about what to do? And the context also, as you mentioned earlier on, of course, is the government in the US is still printing money like you wouldn't believe through the bond issuance. And that's another factor in all of this, which is also explaining why bond yields are higher too.
I guess the other thing we check in on from time to time is the trueflation data. And that has remained pretty low, between 1% and 2%. We've had a couple of spikes, but this tends to be a good few months in front of the official data as well. So that's another thing just to keep in mind, that the trueflation is saying that, yeah, it is going to get down between that band nicely in the US.
Yeah, it could well. I think the critical thing to watch will be services inflation, excluding housing. I expect the rental number to come in a little bit lower. But the wage growth is still quite strong, and that's flowing into services costs. So if you see a spike in services costs and therefore inflation, that could negate the expectation of lower inflation. So, you know, there's a lot to play for. It'd be interesting to see how the data shapes up ahead.
Absolutely. All right. Next up, we've got Trump's man talking about no cuts.
This was such quite an interesting article. Now, you know, who's going to win the election? Who knows? But Trump's potential candidate to be Jerome Powell's replacement was interviewed, and he said, well, you know, don't see any reason to actually want to cut rates anytime soon. And I thought that was quite interesting that both sides of politics are sort of playing politics with the interest rates as well. Who knows? But there is more concern now, maybe, and the markets are actually taking out a lot of the rate cuts they're expecting. No one's pricing a rate hike in the markets yet, but, you know, watch this space is what I'd say.
Okay, next up, over to the Eurozone.
Yeah, so Eurozone, of course, the economies in the Eurozone are not doing so well as the US, and the expectation has been for some time that the ECB might cut interest rates first, although many people would say, well, they won't if the Fed isn't going to cut. But I just wanted to highlight that not all of the economies in the Eurozone are actually performing equally well or equally badly. Interestingly, some of those in Southern Europe, which traditionally have not been performing that well, are doing quite a lot better. Spain, for example, is doing quite a lot better, and some of the other Southern Mediterranean countries, whereas France and Germany are the ones really under the gun at the moment. So within the Eurozone, you've got quite a spectrum of behaviors at the moment, quite a spectrum of outcomes, which again is going to make the ECB's job of trying to actually work out what to do with regard to rates quite difficult. The latest ECB speak is we will cut at some point, but we're waiting for more data. So the thematic is we need to see more data. Funny that.
Yes. And then over to Japan, where, as you mentioned before, consequences of the US dollar getting stronger.
Yes. And of course, in Japan, they actually did move one of their key target rates just slightly higher. So that's a changing a strategy that's been, you know, in negative territory for quite some time. We've seen the Japanese stock market reach new highs and then come back. We've seen the yen a little stronger on the assumption that the Japanese government will support the yen to try and actually keep it. But the question is, will some of those flows effectively negate some of this change that's been happening in Japan? Inflation in Japan is still quite high. The government sort of jawboning the yen is right in the front and center, but the Japanese bank, a bit like the ECB, is saying, well, you know, we're looking at the data, but we may have to do some stuff. So I think it's worth watching Japan. And as you say, a very significant link between what happens in Japan and the US dollar and what happens in the US.
Yes. Next up, so gold and oil higher, a lot of things higher, Martin. Do you want to share any thoughts on this? Then I'll share some.
Yeah, so just on gold. So gold has reached new highs again. And, you know, there's a few reasons. We know that quite a lot of the central banks are still buying gold, particularly in Asia and in Eastern Europe. We know that in some countries, the ETFs linked to gold are actually quite strong. We also know that there have been a lot of option plays as well. And it's worth just noting that, you know, the gold bugs have been talking gold to 5,000 for years and years and years and years, and now are sort of really activated, saying, I see, it's this is the time. Well, let's see. On the other hand, oil is also up. And of course, that's more to do with the instability in the Middle East and what's going on down there. But of course, higher oil prices translate to higher inflationary forces around the world. So, you know, there's some different things going on. But you know, it looks as though all asset classes are almost irrespective of where you look are all going in the same direction. I still wonder, well, how much of this is fundamentals and how much of this is hopium and how much of it is just more dollars sloshing around the place?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. That's kind of when my financial journey was starting during the GFC, 08, 09, and gold and silver were peaking at that time. And the same people saying $600 silver and $5,000-$10,000 gold have been saying the same thing for 12 years. So half the problem with investing is timing the market rather than saying, see, I told you all along. But yeah, I think one of the things we've seen in China is a lot of Chinese physical buying demand from customers. And as you mentioned, some of those ETFs trading at a large premium. And the other thing in the crypto space, I guess, we've got the announcement that a lot of these big Chinese funds now want to launch Bitcoin ETFs because of the success of BlackRock in the US. And they're trying to do these via their Hong Kong subsidiaries because obviously there's still a lot of crackdown on crypto in China itself. So I think that's all really interesting that Chinese citizens are looking for a way out of the system, just as a lot of Westerners are looking to gold or Bitcoin or trying to get out of that fiat currency system.
Well, clearly, confidence in China with regard to the economy there and, you know, house prices are way down and concerns about what's going on. So maybe it's not surprising that some investors from China are looking for safer alternatives. And of course, you know, the argument has been that that gold and silver are, you know, relatively safe havens. They protect against inflationary outcomes or the devaluation of fiat, I guess. But we'll see how it plays out. Silver, of course, is now knocking on 28. US, which is another high. And, you know, I was listening to some silver bulls the other day celebrating that finally their day has come. I still believe that over time, commodities go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. So I'm not sure necessarily that this is a one-way trajectory, but I guess we will see.
Yes, very true. Okay, next up. So banking resolution, IMF pushing harder for better controls after the bank runs we saw and how quickly some of those banks collapsed, smaller banks in the US, yeah, over the past year or two.
So it's quite interesting. This was actually the IMF blog, and they were saying that they'd done some analysis on recent bank failures in the US, and also, of course, the the problem in Switzerland with Credit Suisse there. And they made the point that with the rise of digital and online transactions, the ability to create bank runs was actually much quicker. And so that's what the chart on the right is showing, that it's actually happened much quicker than, say, Northern Rock in the UK in 2007. But one of the really interesting things that they're pushing for, of course, is the so-called living will, or the how do you actually deal with a bank that actually gets into difficulty. And one of the things that's very much part of their suite is the bank bail-in of deposits and other assets. And because what they're trying to avoid is that effectively governments bail banks out. Now, of course, in the US, guess what? The banks were ultimately bailed out through the deposit insurance schemes that the Fed sort of underwrote. And in Europe, the Credit Suisse issue was solved by the Swiss government effectively underwriting the merger. So in both cases, the intent to actually isolate the financial system from taxpayer intervention has once again failed. And so the IMF is once again reminding everybody, well, of course, we want to find a way where you can actually get shareholders and bondholders and ultimately maybe even depositors to take more of the risk. And I always come back to the fact that, of course, many people, when they think about the banking system, don't understand that effectively deposits in the bank are unsecured loans effectively to the bank. And so there's a whole bunch of issues here. And the IMF is still preaching. And of course, the IMF is very much leading the charge, along with a few other of these non-governmental organizations that sit across the financial system and throw rocks at it a little bit. Bank for International Settlements is another one, of course. And my concern is that some of this stuff is being propagated down into countries, including Australia. If the IMF says do this, or the Bank for International Settlements do this, or the World Economic Forum says do this, and I keep coming back to, well, hang on a moment, these guys are not elected. They're sitting there in splendid isolation, and there is no way that these things should be brought in top down. We need to have more consultation and be more involved and engaged with some of these issues, because these things can fundamentally change the way that the financial system works without really any accountability or authority.
Yeah, I guess my overall thoughts on the banking system in that regard, they just need to be treated more as like some sort of public utility, whether or not that goes back to being government owned or not. But it shouldn't just be the case that they're making these record profits, hell or high water. In COVID, they get all this money printed for them and whatever. And if things are going good, they're making record profits. If things are going bad, they're making record profits. We need to sort of, whether or not the answer is crypto and these public utilities that are owned by the users or not, but just the way that all these banks in every country have got so big and closed down their regional centers and all that type of thing. It's just all about profit first. It's not about customers at all. So it's just another thing that's become out of government control almost, because the corporations have more money than the government.
Well, that's right. And they have a lot of authority and influence and a lot of lobbying power with regard to governments. And I remind everybody that post the 2007 issues in the US, almost no bankers were actually charged with anything, despite the fact they clearly caused the problem in the first place. Yes. And nothing has changed dramatically. And in fact, the quantum of debt in the system is much higher than it was. So the risks are still there. And the question is, who's going to actually ultimately pick up the pieces if it goes wrong? And the answer is, well, taxpayers predominantly, but maybe ordinary people with savings in the banks are also potentially at risk. And that's part of the issue, why people are saying, well, maybe we should look for a thing beyond the banking system to find a little bit more safety. And, that's fully understandable given what we're seeing at the moment.
All right. Next up, Australia exposed to iron ore prices and I guess commodity prices in general falling.
Yeah, so the latest trade data from the Australian perspective wasn't very good news. It was pretty weak. And, China is being a little bit more coy in terms of what it's imported. But the iron ore price has dropped dramatically. And that chart just shows you that, the archetypal movement. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that Australian iron ore is losing money. But the massive premiums that we're able to get for a long period of time, and that flowed through into significant tax takes and everything else, is probably at an end. And I was again reading something the other day suggesting that the journey for iron ore is going to continue down. We also have, of course, questions about some of the other commodities too. And so if you stand back and look at some of the latest data for Australia, some of the business confidence data and some of the other information that's come up more recently, it looks to me as though the US economy is probably going to survive quite well, but the Australian economy looks to me to be teetering quite close to a significant downturn. And that's a significant factor. If in fact, you know, iron ore goes off the boil, we are so much reliant on commodities. And basically the two things that Australia is reliant on are commodities, you know, houses and holes, and also houses, commodities, houses. Right. So the moment commodities look a little bit concerning. And that this is one to watch, because if the iron ore price continues to go down or sideways, tax rates lower, that's going to have a dent on the economy more broadly.
Yes, great point, Martin. So housing market here and some big differentials in terms of the annual growth of these capital cities around the country.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting because houses and homes, you know, well, homes is a big part of the Australian economy. There's some data showing that a massive proportion of the wealth of Australians is in houses. But it is just worth looking at this chart that shows you how different the story is. So if you look at Hobart over the last year, prices have dropped about 1.65% according to PropTrack. If you compare that with Perth, annual growth rate was 18.6%. And then if you look at Sydney versus Melbourne, or you know, Brisbane versus Adelaide, you can see there's some quite big differences. So the point I want to make is that we have a lot of very different housing markets in Australia. And even these aggregate numbers down at those particular cities mask a whole lot of diversity as to what's going on. But the truth is that in different parts of the country, prices are going in quite different directions for very different drivers. And I do think that the Tasmanian story is quite concerning insofar that they had a massive run-up a few years ago. Now we're seeing quite big exits. We're seeing investors selling in Sydney and Melbourne as well, and now buying in Perth because that's where the annual growth has been. And the expectation, I guess, is that they think it's going to continue. My point would be also be that these movements are so extreme that it's unlikely that we're going to see this continuing over the next year or two, particularly if interest rates stay high for longer. So, you know, this is a bit of a crazy story, and I wanted to highlight just how crazy it really is.
Yeah, always interesting to look at those numbers, particularly the median value in Hobart, the same as median value in Perth now. I find that pretty interesting.
It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah. But if you then look at the next slide, right? So prices are stupid. Yeah, there's no way other than to say prices are stupid relative to wages and income. This is from this chart on the left is from AMP, from Shane Oliver. And it just shows that the ratio of average home prices to average wages has gone through the roof. And then the ABC published an article recently just highlighting that the income needed to afford a house in each capital city. And those numbers are aggressive. I mean, just, you know, if you think about it, in Sydney, you need almost $300,000 to be able to afford to buy a property. It's a bit easier down in Hobart, $148,000, and Perth, $140,000. And in a way, those different movements of income helps to explain some of the differences in terms of the dynamics of the property market. But interestingly, those incomes are not anything close to the average household income in each of the capital cities.
Yeah, and I guess that just drives home the point about how the wealthy are the ones with the assets and the ones that are least affected when interest rates rise, and all they effectively do is slam the brakes on the lower income and middle income bracket of Australians. And then those houses that get put on the market get swept up by the people that do have the assets. So again, it's just this system that we have isn't actually working for everyone. Okay, next up, rental stress through the roof.
Yeah. So the latest data from the DFA surveys, which is just out, shows that rental stress continues to rise. 75% of those in the rental sector are having cash flow issues. The mortgage stress was slightly down a little bit, just under half of households now with cash flow issues, thanks partly to income rises and also to the fact that people have been able to restructure their mortgages. But I just want to highlight the rental sector story is very significant now. And in fact, if you look, it's almost all of the main areas in the main urban centres where you've got a lot of people in difficulty, and rents are still rising. So I was talking to somebody the other day who's got a 20% rise in their rent starting next month, and they're trying to work out whether it's actually worth trying to find something else or whether they're going to have to pay. And if they do pay, they're going to have to give up something else because, you know, they just can't manage it all. So the rental system is absolutely broken in Australia with limited supply and massive migration. So this is just another snapshot of what's going on.
Yeah. Next up here, this is similar to what we mentioned in the US before in terms of the actual number of full-time employment dropping.
Yeah, so there's a lot of multi-jobs, a lot of people with part-time jobs. And so the actual official number from the ABS dropped a little, unsurprisingly. But the truth is that a lot of people have a lot of part-time jobs trying to get by earning a little more. And the problem there, of course, is the limit to how many of those that you can do. A lot of people are running around like headless chickens trying to generate a bit more income to cover all the costs. And that's one of the reasons why the stress levels are so high. And it's very important that we watch the underemployment data ahead, because if it continues to rise, as I think it probably will, then that's going to be another leading indicator of more trouble ahead.
Absolutely. Okay, so we all know about migration being pretty crazy. We've spoken about this at length, and now we've seen a few of these other countries do something about it. So is Australia going to follow suit?
Yeah, it is interesting. As Tarek in a recent post said, well, Canada, New Zealand and the UK have all admitted that migration is unsustainable, and New Zealand actually introduced some tightening rules on visas. It's worth highlighting that we really haven't done much here, although there's a lot of talk about it. And it's worth noting that as the migration rate started to uptick in January 2022 or a bit after, then the median advertised rents started shooting up. So there's a direct correlation with high migration and rents going through the roof. So unless we can actually get migration under control, and there's very little evidence that I think Albo is serious. He's talking about, well, you know, we're just catching up from the dip through COVID, but of course that's a bit I think myopic in terms of talking about it like that. But the point is that the rentals and the rental crisis is directly contingent upon high migration, and so far there's no interest in dealing with migration. So GDP per capita goes backwards, and whilst the maximum impact on GDP could be positive, the true impact on households is negative.
Yes, absolutely. All right, rate impact harder in Oz, says the IMF.
Yeah, so it's just worth highlighting that there was this article that said that IMF is saying that, you know, rates are lower here. You know, in New Zealand, it's 5.5. They just kept it on hold again for the next and foreseeable future, actually. Same in the UK. It's lower in Australia. And part of the reason is that we've got more variable rate mortgages and bigger mortgages. But they're arguing that there's a really significant question now as to whether, in fact, this is going to have an impact. And if it does have an impact, does it mean we're not going to be able to get rates down? If we're not going to get rates down, is it going to impact the economy more significantly? And, you know, things like the rapid decline in real per capita household consumption is now coming through. And that's another impact as well. So I thought it was quite an interesting article and just shows that Australia is out on a limb and we've got probably a weaker economy. We've got more exposure to debt because of the high household debt, and yet our interest rates are lower. But maybe the capacity for the Reserve Bank to cut is more limited. And in fact, the next article highlights that there are now more and more doubts building that the RBA will be able to cut rates in 2024. Investors are becoming increasingly skeptical that the Reserve Bank of Australia will need to cut interest rates any time this year, after more upbeat data in the US reinforces expectations that borrowing costs in the world's largest economy will remain high for longer. So this is the connection between what's happening in Australia and the US, as I mentioned earlier on. And so if the US economy continues to bubble along, then the chances of the RBA cutting pretty much goes out the window.
Yeah, I think also just noting the political pressure for the RBA to follow what the Fed do. But then if we go back to that slide, I think so many people would just be unaware that share of fixed rate mortgages in Australia is somewhere between 10 and 20%. And then in the US, you know, up around between 90 and 100%. So there's big differences in terms of how the changes of adjusting interest rates hit people and what people they hit. And yet those actual levers, the interest rates, are so similar in all these different countries. So as you said, it's going to impact Australia in a very different way.
Spot on. So watch this space. And then I first thought I'd highlight a couple of significant developments. So the first one is on the 2nd of April, there was an initiative to get people to use cash at the ATMs. And this is part of a campaign to make sure that people understand how important cash is. A lot of people did. And so we had photographs of queues. The latest data showed an uptick in the use of cash, which is interesting. On the other hand, CEO of CBA, Matt Comyn, brain sort of stormed an idea, well, maybe we should only allow cash transactions below $500, right? Reminiscent of the cash ban campaigns we ran a few years ago. Point is, cash is really important, particularly when the power goes out, particularly to keep your identity safe and secure. And, you know, it's actually, cash is in legal tender, so we should be able to use it. So this is a really important campaign. It's now taking off. There's a talk about using this initiative perhaps every few weeks, just to underscore that cash is really important.
Yeah, completely agree with that as well. And it ties into the digital ID, which we'll get to in just a second. But this was interesting about the exchange settlement balances. And I know around the world, a lot of the reserve ratios and whatnot have changed since COVID for different banking systems. And the Fed saying, don't worry about it. We'll be the lender of last resort to ensure customer deposits, which we touched on before. But what are your thoughts on this, Martin?
Yeah, so the RBA has come out with a consultation paper issued on the 4th of April. Submission closes the 10th of May. But essentially what it's doing is it's changing the way that it actually is interacting with the banking system. And it means that they won't have to hold such big balances, and it gives them more dynamic control, they say. But of course, it also means that we're going to see potentially different relationships between the central bank and the retail banks. It actually allows the retail banks potentially to hold lower assets at the central bank, which gives them more capacity to do things. So in fact, it could be beneficial to the retail banks. The question is there sufficient in the system here to protect the financial system? And, you know, the RBA is saying, well, it will give us more a power to be able to control the way that rates run. But I think there's some big questions that I'll be making a more detailed show on this, because this is an hour conversation on this alone. But I wanted to highlight that along with other central banks, the RBA is going down the same route. Once again, we are following other central banks around the world. And I argue that central banks don't think in isolation. They're very much linked back through the Bank for International Settlements. And what we'd find in Australia and elsewhere is we get the same sorts of policies being propagated as came out from the Federal Reserve and other places first. So, you know, we're just following.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we touched on before, maybe take some of those record profits and increase your reserves and make the banks steadier. But no, the banks are the ones that never lose out.
Well, and of course, the banks are highly exposed to derivatives and highly exposed to trading and those sorts of things. So, you know, the meat and potatoes banking has got lost in the maze here. And unfortunately, the regulators around the world don't want to actually tackle those fundamental issues. They don't want to actually make the banking system safer, despite the fact they say they do. So that's a real issue.
All right. So the digital ID, we've both been talking and tweeting a lot about this, and this was all stuff that was conspiracy theory even just 5 years ago when we said that. Now here it is on our doorstep being passed through the Senate. So one more step to go. But what are your thoughts on all this, Martin?
Well, of course, two things. Firstly, you and I have been talking about if you join the dots between central bank digital currencies, digital ID, and, you know, the banking system, you've got much more control. And of course, there are people who've been advocating for this in the context of don't use cash anymore. You know, we want to track all transactions. We want to be able to give people credit scores and those sorts of things, and also social scores. And there are other countries around the world more advanced. Unfortunately, Labour's now basically rammed this through the Senate. And there wasn't sufficient debate, wasn't any debate really about this. And, you know, news.com.au saying dystopian, that's probably not far off the mark. But of course, the Labour guys are saying, oh, no, nothing to see here. Let's move on. I'm quite concerned about this. And I think there's a really important lobbying exercise now to be done with the lower house. This has got to come back to the lower house because some of the changes. They haven't dealt with the fundamental question here. And I'm very concerned about the idea of a digital ID. Although in theory being voluntary, But in actual fact, it becomes, you know, if you don't have a digital ID, you can't do stuff. And that's the problem. So you get to the point where you are forced to do it. And then those who would prefer to be able to control things more can join the dots. And so I'm very concerned about this. I think it's a civil liberties issue. It's a freedom issue. And it's a question of where do we want to go? And I use the analogy of the frog in the hot water. You know, over the years, more and more of our freedoms have been taken away. We've ended up with a top-down controlling mentality coming from those in power. And this is just one more step.
Yeah, time for more decentralization, Martin, if you believe privacy is a basic human right. And we've all heard that word voluntary too many times over the past few years, and we all know how that played out. But final slide, you got a bit of humor for us?
Well, just to, not partly humor, but also, you know, the floods that have been in Australia recently, this is actually down in the Illawarra, of course, I know very well. And I'm just astonished by the amount of water that came through, washed out railway lines, washed out services. And two observations. A lot of people have actually found that they can't afford their home insurance because of the other costs that we touched on earlier on. Some people haven't got flood insurance at all or very limited flood insurance. That's a big deal when you actually see this. The land of flooding, you know, rain, there are risks attached, you know. And we're going to see more of this, I think, ahead. So this is a big deal. More importantly, we know that there's a lot of property being built even now on floodplains. And that means that there are areas around some of the major cities that are really up against it now. We've got to expect these sorts of storms to be more frequent ahead. So now this is just an example of how some of those things over the horizon, you know, are beginning to hit us quite significantly. And Australia is right in the crosshairs. And unfortunately, households without insurance are right on the front line of this. But more broadly, this can have a huge impact on insurers, a huge impact on the broader economy, and we're going to see more of it, unfortunately.
I thought you might have had a lighter note about the flooding of immigrants or something as well, Martin, with that one, so I've misread that one there to finish, but no, that's all good. I hope you guys have enjoyed that show at home. Hit that like button, subscribe if you haven't already, share these videos around. The links to follow Martin and all his great content are below, and we'll talk to you again next month. Thanks, Martin.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Cheers.